PHP Radio
on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network,
your number one source for all things golf.
Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.
Hello, you golfing legends, and welcome back to another episode of the Original Off Course. I'm your host, Dan Edwards, and I'm very excited to introduce this week Mr. Greg Nathan. He is the president and CEO of the National Golf Foundation. Greg, welcome.
Thank you, Dan. Greetings. Good to talk to you.
It is awesome to have you on. I think our audience is a little bit more on the go play golf kind of side of things rather than the figure out golf kind of side of things. But we're always analyzing the situation that the golf industry is in, the results of tour, the types of equipment that come out. That happens to be, I feel like, the depth of NGF at its core. And what I would love for you to do is to get people started in this discussion today is introduce what is the National Golf Foundation and how long you've been around and what you serve.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I get to spend every day talking to business leaders across the spectrum of golf business categories. And luckily, thanks to some people who've run the NGF for the last 89 years, we've got a really solid base of credibility and trust. And we have become best known, Dan, as being golf's research and data company. And we're independent and objective. And so we are here to provide, you know, in certain ways, the unvarnished truth about what's going on with the golf economy. And, you know, those 25 full-time employees who work here, we're all very entrenched in the game and passionate. And our goal is to help golf businesses be more successful. There's a couple of ways that we do that. One is the foundation, and you think about that word. We are a 501c6. Essentially, we are the trade association for every golf-related business. But we also have a wholly owned subsidiary, National Golf Foundation Consulting, where we get hired by many of the biggest brands in golf across the different categories to do for them private research, marketing, both consulting and execution, and different types of consulting. And so, as I said, I feel incredibly fortunate that I get to go study the golf economy, supply and demand, but I also get invited inside golf companies because we're here to help them. And so that's what gives us a 360-degree view, Dan, that our members and clients really love. Is that they know we have the data, they know we understand the golf industry, and we also get to bring to the party that we are deeply entrenched in the leading companies in every sector. Yeah, so that's probably it in a nutshell. So
that's great.
It's a big nutshell.
Yeah, and what I love about it is I went into the about researched as much as I could about the NGF prior to the show. I've definitely heard, since it's not directly tied to me, I've heard the value added that you guys bring on a daily basis to the folks who make big decisions for what me and my people like to do is go and play golf or use the golf clubs and where to go. So what's interesting to me is I had no idea you got started. And you're almost 100 years old now, not you, the company, starting like in the era of the Great Depression, redefining golf and allowing it to emerge from a really dark place in the country's history. So I assume and I hope you got a little bit of information that you can provide on how that kickstarted NGF in total and how that sort of changed over the years, because and I'm loading you up here. So hang in there for 1 second. We've seen different ebbs and flows of the golf industry. Right now, it's kind of nuts. You started with NGF, I think, in 2007, and that was in a really interesting time in its well. Business golf was huge. Casual golf wasn't as high. Like, you've seen all kinds of different places. So from an NGF standpoint, it's interesting that you start at such a prominent time, getting away from a very tough time in the world, and now you've moved into this new space where you're pushing these companies forward.
Well, you touched on an interesting thing. So 2007, where the NGF created the position that had me move from suburban New York down to Florida, they created the position because they wanted to expand the consulting business. But you brought up sort of NGF being founded during the middle of the Great Depression. Well, guess what happened right after they decided to invest in me in 2007 was the Great Recession of 08 and 09. So I'll use that sort of as a springboard to go back in history to let's just go to the late 1920s. So most people who have, had the crazy idea to think about what golf was like in America in the early 20th century would know that golf was almost exclusively private. From that period of the, 1888 through the Great Depression. So what was going on in our founders, our co-founders' minds, Herb and Joe Graffas, two brothers from Chicago, journalists by trade, what was going through their mind was, wait a second, golf is almost purely private right now in America, but we see a totally different future. And we think golf is going to be part of the American dream, and that the golf business is going to be huge in America. Now, there's people with vision, and there's people with vision who have tools to make that vision actually become reality. And if you think about the fact that Herb and Joe were journalists, they actually had a way to make it so, to promote the game of golf through their resources and through their skills. So in 1927, Herb and Joe founded the first national publication for people who ran golf courses. Okay. And that was called Golfdom. Now, Golfdom still exists. It's a magazine for the turf industry. They're members of the NGF, great guys who run that company. But Golfdom in 1927 was distributed to about 300 greenskeepers, club managers, and pros to help them deliver the product of golf. And then 1933, they founded the first national publication for golfers called Golfing. And so through those vehicles, they started to promote the game and the expansion of the game and get more people interested. That's where NGF's roots are in promotion. But with the Great Depression, let's just say maybe there were 5,000 courses going into the Great Depression. Maybe there were only 4,000 coming out. Nobody was sure. But golf equipment back then, something you and I both are passionate about, love the sticks and balls and everything that goes with it. Well, guess what? There was no PGA Tour Superstore back then. Everything was sold at the golf course. So one of Herb and Joe's first jobs they ever did was to create the inventory of golf courses in America that still existed coming out of the Great Depression. And it's not a surprise that they would do that as one of their first jobs, because the six founding members of the National Golf Foundation were golf equipment companies, club and ball companies, some of which exist today, and some of which nobody's heard about in decades, like the Worthington Golf Ball Company or US Rubber. But we're delighted to still be doing after all these years, still be doing business with Wilson, for example, who's one of our founding members, also from Chicago, where the guys are from. So that's sort of how the NGF got started. And we also have a history of doing some things that people wouldn't even know. Like, we actually had a field staff, like in the 1950s and 60s, where we sent people out to talk to municipalities about creating golf courses to serve their communities with recreation. We literally wrote the book on municipal golf. I wish I could hold it up for you right now, but it was a book about how to build and operate a municipal golf course. During World War II, where all the rubber supplies in America were being used for the war effort, Well, that meant that there was no golf ball manufacturing being done. So the NGF actually created a golf ball reconditioning program where people could bring used golf balls into golf shops, and those golf shops would send the balls to an NGF chosen facility for those golf balls to be refinished so that golf could continue to be played during the war effort where no balls were being manufactured. Of course, you could fast forward and come to the place where David Huber and Joe Bettis basically turned the NGF into a different organization. You know, the beginnings of NGF becoming golf's research and data organization. And that sort of evolved even more through the last 20 years, roughly, that I've been here, where we've really expanded our capabilities to help golf businesses. You know, it's sort of like the NGF as a 501c6 exists to help the industry be more successful, to help the collective. And then the consulting business at NGF is designed to serve the one. The individual company that we could help. And so today I'm so fortunate. I look out at the industry and I'm confident enough in NGF's capabilities to say that I don't think there's a golf business in the country or the world that we can't help if given the opportunity. And so that's sort of become my life's work.
I think it's really interesting. You have all these different segments of history that are all quite interesting in themselves, but they all served in pretty pivotal moments for the golf industry in America. There's a whole segment on that you mentioned on supporting teachers and getting more education on the skill-based side of the game. There's the engagement you have with the agronomers out there trying to improve their facilities, or you know, trying to encourage communities to introduce golf in a higher level. I saw an old article on pace of play, like was it Speedy Squads or something like that, which is pretty funny.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
All these different things that you do throughout the timeline of the company that were truly pivotal moments for the game. So currently your primary focus is on that data collection and analysis. It would make sense to me that is where you believe is the primary benefit of the NGF at this time. Do you see that shifting in another way, or have you really found your niche?
You know, one of the things we really value, Dan, is that we're always evolving, and we're always evolving to do, this is what we strive for. Hopefully we do it. We try to focus on what the golf industry needs most at a given time. There have been periods of our history where that had to do with golf being limited based on not having enough golf courses. There have been moments in time where we had more than enough golf courses and not enough golfers, so we'd focus more on player development. So we are always looking to change based on what the industry needs most. And I think if you were to look around the country and around the world at different industries, you'd be surprised that there aren't a lot of organizations like ours who exist to study the business of recreational golf or whatever that business is and report to the business leaders to give them insight into trends and the directions that the business may go. And, you know, it's an interesting and important role. I don't say that as a self-important. I say it because golf-related businesses need independent information. You know, there are organizations in golf who are not so focused on recreational golf, where their business is based on, you know, television viewers or sponsorship sales or commercial, you know, advertising sales. And those businesses, you know, it's like being a sports league. You know, the PGA Tour, just as one example, they're a professional sports league. They have a whole different set of metrics that their success depends on versus recreational golf. And all the businesses supported by someone like you or me who raises their hand and says, I'm going to go to a golf course and I'm going to pay a greens fee. Because the golf industry, the recreational golf industry doesn't exist unless that happens. And guess what? It's happening more today than it's ever happened in the history of golf in America in terms of the number of rounds of golf. And we still have upside. You know, we're producing the largest, I think 4 out of the last 4 years, Dan, have been the all-time high watermark in rounds. But we're not at the high watermark in golfers right now. We're around 28, you know, the last year's measure was 28.1 million green grass golfers. The all-time is about 30.5 million.
Wow.
And that doesn't even, we haven't even gotten in yet to off course, which of course the eponymous, title of podcast. So,
yeah, I'm really, really curious about the last 20 years because that's the stretch of golf that I'm really familiar with post-college. I've belonged to the same course for 25 years now, and the ability to get on that has changed dramatically over the last 5 years, let alone the last 15. And it's an interesting yet wonderful yet frustrating scenario where this game that I love is being sort of taken over by people who are just as feverish and excited to play as I am, but then managing those expectations, the timelines, the availability of many things is the crux of the challenge that myself and many others face in my position as a player. So I'd love to hear your perspective. And since you have so much data at the ready, what has the last 20 years looked like from a metrics perspective? Is it shocking? Is it manageable? Is it unsustainable?
You know, that's one of the more common questions that we get, Dan, is this incredible generational period in recreational golf? Is it sustainable? And the honest truth is we don't see any metrics right now that really tell us that that's not possible. I always, when asked, would say that the biggest threats to golf are, you know, a geopolitical event for certain, a recession, which would negatively impact any form of recreation, especially golf or others that are pay for play, you know, versus taking a basketball down to a schoolyard. And the availability and affordability of water. You know, those are the three main things that we look at that are the biggest threats. But the metrics that we look at relative to engagement with the greengrass game, the 28.1 million on-course golfers, that's up 16% since pre-COVID, since 2019. The number of off-course participants passed the number of on-course in 2022. There's a particularly interesting milestone for the industry, but currently we're at 36 million people in America participate in one of the three off-course forms that we think are important to put in that number. And those three forms are traditional driving range, whether it's tech-enabled or not, golf entertainment like Topgolf, or screen golf. Now, we care about those because they're hitting a real ball with a real club with a full swing. That's why we only count those in that one particular big number. I mean, we think Pop Stroke is doing a great job, and there are a number of other ways you can engage in the game. But those three, because you're hitting a real ball with a real club with a full swing, you can get shot euphoria, golf's drug.
Sure. Yeah, and absolutely.
And through our study of how people get hooked on the game, Dan, you cannot get hooked on the game unless you get shot euphoria. You have to get it. You have to get it at least once or twice every time that you go out. It's also one of the reasons why we think often that some of the ways that golf instruction is delivered in terms of growing the game. I'm not talking about like a 7 handicap trying to become a 4. I'm talking about instruction for someone that is maybe marginally attached to the game that we would like to become one of golf's best customers. They need to show up at one of their earliest lessons and put the ball on a tee and hit a 9-iron. Okay, so there's a whole school of thought about learning the game, you know, from the putting green going out. And there's plenty of arguments we could make as to why that's intelligent. But you're not going to get shot euphoria in your first lesson from doing that.
Yeah, so there are two segments there that are quite interesting. The driving range is what it is. Top Golf coming out and convincing golfers that they're playing golf and non-golfers that they're not playing golf, I think is one of the more curious avenues we've taken as a collective. We've seen some replication or duplication of that concept, which is amazing. It's not exactly the most cost-conscious experience you can have. The one that's really fascinating to me, Greg, is the introduction and almost takeover of the digital golf game. So simulator golf, we've started to do it here in Cincinnati during the winter. We'll go down and spend a couple hours at the local sim place. That is a huge boost from my perspective, at least in the discussions we've had on the Hackers Paradise, of everyone is starting to at least consider doing it, if not already fully invested in doing it. Have you seen that in a data perspective as well, that this is a real significant boom? And do you think the technology that has improved is supporting this?
Well, screen golf is exploding. Screen golf is up, you know, over 125% since pre-COVID, since 2019. So those numbers are massive. And you said something earlier that maybe I didn't answer, which actually connects these two things, which is I sympathize with people who like to play a particular golf course and it's just become, packed to the gills and you're not able to get a tee time that you want or not able to get a tee time on Saturday when you really like to play. Well, the first thing about that, Dan, is the golf industry is cyclical. And even when the golf industry is doing well, there are going to be categories of the business that are going to be doing well and some that aren't going to be doing that well. And we've had lengthy periods of time where, for example, the golf club business has really been experiencing fantastic growth, but the golf course business has not. And so I'd be the last person to say now that golf course owners and operators finally are in a wonderful position based on capacity of tee sheets being filled, based on them having pricing power for the first time in over a generation to raise their rates and get it. Golf courses being financially healthy is incredibly important to the golf industry. I'll take that a step further. So we would, as the NGF, we divide the industry up into two hemispheres. There's companies whose end customer is a golfer, and there's companies whose end customer is a decision maker at a golf course. So think about what I said. It's like golf facility financial health means that an entire half of the golf industry is going to be more healthy because they can afford to get new golf cars. They can afford to get a new fairway mower. They can afford to do renovations on the clubhouse. They can afford to redo the bunkers. And so an entire half of the industry is supported by golf facility financial health. So back to capacity. So public golf courses, in our last measure, we asked them, you know, to what level are you at or near capacity where if you were any more busy, it would really hurt your delivery of the product? It would hurt the customer experience. So for public golf, that's around 60% say we're at or near capacity. For private golf, it's nearly 80%. I think last time we looked, 77% at or near capacity. So what does that mean? Well, it means those who want to participate in golf at a particular day and a particular time where they can't get the tee time they're looking for, well, they might be able to play it on a simulator. They might be able to play at a Topgolf. And so the pie, the entire golf pie, has gotten so much larger. And that's a real plus. And there are other opportunities. And look, I love the green grass game. I'm an entrenched, you know, five handicap golfer, and I wanna take some turf. I wanna hit golf shots on grass. But the overlap is quite significant. I mean, if you think there's 47 million Americans who play both on and off. Okay, 47 million if you combine the two. Total off course, 36 million. Total on course, 28 million. And there's a significant center of the Venn diagram, you know, for the two sides. So they tend to feed off each other. Jeff Cottrell, who's a former chief brand officer of Topgolf, I'll use his saying, which was, he loves a band called Radiohead. Are you familiar with Radiohead?
I am, yeah.
All right, so Jeff Cottrell loves Radiohead. He says, my love for Radiohead, it's unlimited, okay? I bought Radiohead albums. I would go see Radiohead concerts. I'd buy Radiohead T-shirts. And that's what's going on in golf. It's just the pie is getting larger in the ways that you can experience Radiohead, or the ways you can experience golf in that analogy. It's just expanding every day.
Yeah, it's one thing that I've been really fascinated about, because there has been a significant shift of the mindset. It used to be, if you got on a simulator, you were just practicing, I guess you'd say, or getting fit or something like that. And now it almost feels like there's room for people to just totally give up the actual green grass component of it and say, my entire focus is simulator golf. It's where I like to play. It's what I like to do. I don't want to go out and wait in the lines. I just want to go and hit balls. So I'm really curious to see, and maybe you have a perspective on this, whether golf becomes more dynamic than all-encompassing, and whether we can sort of focus individually on these types of things. Like, listen, I have a rowing machine in my basement. There's no way I'm getting in a kayak anytime soon. You know what I mean? So does golf end up becoming the same thing, where it's so accessible that it stops being multi-layered and sort of being a singular focus for each player?
You know, I don't see that in my own view of the future. And I mean, I've had conversations, very interesting conversations, with people who've been in the industry for a long time, who, when I'll talk to them about, you know, where do you think golf's growth might come from? And they'll mention, you know, screen golf. You know, and this might be a very well-traveled individual who's gone to South Korea and seen that in Seoul, there's more than 5,000 screen golf cafes. I think NGF even did a little calculation that if we had as many in the United States, if we had as many screen golf facilities, the same proportion as South Korea, we'd need like 360,000 or some like absolutely insane number. So the I went off track a little bit there, but my point is that I don't believe that while there's tons of upside in screen golf, our study of why people play golf, green grass golf, it's because of being outdoors. It's because of exercise. It's because of the camaraderie and being out in nature. It's only a small group of people that play for the competition that are grinding it out. And I applaud those that do. I certainly enjoy doing that sometimes. But it's the intrinsic values that I just rattled off about green grass golf. They're never going to change. I love talking about green grass golf sometimes as an analog experience. It's an analog game. And while I might use Arcos or use my you know, Bushnell or Blue Tees rangefinder, or incorporate different technology into my green grass golf life. It's the being with people. It's the being outdoors, being in nature, hitting golf shots, watching them soar through the air. So these are just, in the Madison Avenue world that I used to live in, you know, these are brand extensions of golf.
I actually read one of the articles on your site earlier talking about executive courses or par three courses. And a lot of this has to do and ties back into the idea that golf in itself has an identity, but so does the places you go and play. If I take my son mini putting, the likelihood of us dressing up in full golf garb is pretty low. We're probably going to rent a putter, but you put him on my course and he's dressed to the nines. He has to have his putter, his glove, his ball, you know, everything really matters. So there's this discussion of golf having its own identity in many different forms, and trying to either convince or persuade people to look at it in certain ways. It seems to me like this is more of a focus on the age group perspective than anything else. But can you give me an idea of how you're looking at different golf courses or the application of golf at these different types of courses, and the things you focus on as to what matters in a mindset perspective?
Sure. Well, I'll start with a number, which is what we call latent demand. So latent demand, defined by the layman's definition, is people interest in golf among people who are not currently playing. Okay? So we ask a question in our annual survey that says to non-greengrass golfers, how interested are you in playing golf now on a golf course? Okay? So there's 29 million Americans not currently playing who are interested in golf. We also have every year roughly 3 million people who try golf for the first time, and another 3 to 3.5 million people every year who are former golfers who reactivate themselves, right? So where's the ultimate place, Dan, for those people who aren't already in the franchise, who aren't committed to the game? Where are the places where they should be able to have the most comfortable transition into golf? And that, to us, and this is an insight that came out of our President's Council, our highest level of membership. We get them together once a year. In fact, next week is the second annual President's Council retreat. And our President's Council said, we want to talk, we want to understand better where someone might transition from being in that latent demand group or being an initial trier of the game into getting committed. And we at the NGF believe very strongly that short courses are underfunded, under-marketed, under-energied in the United States, which generally means everywhere, because we usually go first. And so we think short courses are incredibly important, and we're going to be doing some things to try and build energy around places. You know, you got great exemplars like the Butler Pitch and Putt in Austin or Goat Hill in the San Diego area. That is, you know what I'm talking about. There's just so much energy around those places, the cool factor and how much fun it is to be there. Well, the reason why we have literally millions of failed trials of the green grass game every year, millions of failed trials, people who play a round of golf and then they're like, this isn't fun for me, I'm not going to continue. It's not necessarily because of the three things that everybody says. It takes too long, it's too hard, and it costs too much. It's more about the intimidation in the golf course environment. It's more about how uncomfortable novices and women and people of color and kids feel in the golf course environment. So that hopefully answers, you know, gives you a little bit of our own opinion and insight relative to why a short course is important.
Yeah, I think it does. And I read discussions about how much exposure they have and whether they have social media presence or I think another component. And I don't think I don't know if I read it or not, but just the overall attitude of the location. I think Goat Hill Park is a really interesting point because talk to anyone in the industry and they're like, I just love going and chilling at Goat Hill for a little bit. And the atmosphere there is amazing and everyone's relaxed and just trying to blow some steam and by way of hitting a golf ball. And I feel like that energy should change. Maybe the term executive or short maybe needs to change to something more approachable that casual golfers can really engage with. I think, you know, the idea that we have this discussion a lot on THP, Greg, and it's about is golf stuffy? I think there is a massive benefit to certain golf courses having a membership, all agreeing on etiquette in principle and the expectations that come with being present on the golf course grounds. But the idea that all courses need to be that way is to me crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know how many, you've done some good research. Do you know how many golf facilities there are in America?
No, I don't.
So there's 14,000.
Okay.
So imagine it's literally like more than Starbucks and McDonald's. Okay. So just for scale, that's just mind blowing. So you know what that means is it means there's a lot of variation in the product. Okay. If you had 14,000 Chinese restaurants, you know, people would exhaust their interest in Chinese restaurants, but luckily we got all kinds of choices and that carries over to golf. So I use similar example. If I was on my way to play Seminole, 5 miles south of here, I would completely, and anybody would completely embrace putting on a great crisp polo and, you know, the outfit that you want to wear for that round of golf. You know what that product is, and you're gonna go all in on dressing the part for that particular product. Or on another day, the same golfer goes to the Butler Pitch and Putt and's wearing a cutoff t-shirt and jorts. Now I won't be wearing those.
Well, truth into the life of Greg here, jorts and
Crocs. You know, like, you know, I just happen to be one of those guys that thinks that adults shouldn't wear Crocs, but that's just me. But like, there's so many different ways for people to experience golf, and there should be different dress codes at different places that fit the vibe that the owner and operator are looking for. And, you know, you touched on something at the beginning of your probe. Your probe here, which it still has to do with sort of the variety of what's out there, and it's not always going to be the same, and it's not always going to be stuffy. And you know, I just like it. I like it that there's different things out there. Social media has been really instrumental in changing the image of the game. Okay, where people like to do activities where they get to act like themselves and dress like themselves, and it's not a costume party, you know. And that, you know, golf's popularity and variation in social media has created an environment where a lot more people who are golf interested see people who look like them and who are dressed like them, and who, you know, it sort of gives them a lot more freedom to feel like they can participate in golf as themselves. And that's very powerful. And so golf's image has really come a long way over time during the social media revolution and because of off course. Like if you went to Topgolf tomorrow, you'd see somebody, you might see a 23-year-old executive assistant wearing 3-inch heels hitting balls. And then the next stall over are 3 Harley Davidson guys in biker jackets and chains. And yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice that everything sort of collects together. And my issue with executive courses, reputations in most cases are, well, it's not worth my time, or they don't keep it in good enough condition. And I think that there's obviously a monetary thing there where it's not going to be as pristine as your local private course, but the expectation should still be there that the quality of golf will exist. And the chance, as you mentioned, to hit a flush shot and get sucked in that way is, you know, the critical moment for everyone, and everyone should have that opportunity. I really like that.
Yeah. Not every sport has that addictive drug. No. Golf is very fortunate to have that.
Yeah, I'm curious because I know you're a big architecture guy, and this is something that I'm going to brag a little bit, but I'm bragging to the wrong guy because I know you've played some places, but it also relates to some of what we were saying. I had the privilege of playing Ohio State's Scarlet Course this past weekend, which is an incredible facility built by Alistair McKenzie, or designed by Alistair McKenzie almost 100 years ago. And actually the Gray course, which is the sister course, is like kind of routed in between and through it, which I've never seen before. Really, really cool. But man, it punished me. I went out there expecting to get beat up a little bit. And Alistair was absolutely up to his tricks that you see at Augusta when they slick the greens up there. And, you know, I thought to myself, like, if you put just an everyday golfer, I'm pretty okay at golf. So I can aim and hit reasonably close to target more often than not, I would say. But I was getting these shots where I would hit in a place, and in true McKenzie form, it would go the absolute wrong direction once it landed. I'm like, I just got punched in the mouth for hitting a great shot. So you had mentioned the challenge of golf, and man, I can't imagine what it'd be like as a new golfer to go and play that and think, well, golf kind of sucks. You know?
Yeah.
So accessibility to the quality of course as well, I think is a really interesting point. Getting them in a place that they can actually succeed is also a really important part, because you don't want to get beat up too hard. Let's save it for later down the line where you're totally invested, then you can go get your teeth kicked in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the analogy that we use around here a lot when it comes to that is, like, you would never take someone who's never skied before and just take them yeah. up the ski lift and put them on a double diamond.
Yeah.
You know, the double black diamond. It would never happen. You would die.
Well, maybe that's one thing that golf needs to look into doing. We have course rating, which is, I think you hand an average golfer a course rating card, they're probably going to look at you like, okay, this doesn't mean anything. You show them a ski lift with like a green and then a black diamond, I think everyone knows what you're talking about. That's pretty interesting right there.
Yeah, that's we also look at the other side of it, which is most people who would go to a ski mountain for the first time, they're always going to do a couple hours of ski school.
Yeah.
But yet you have millions of golfers who just, you know, yeah, let's just go to the first tee. I'll try this. And that, yeah, that's a recipe for failed trials, which we see millions of every year.
Well, I would love to hear a little bit more about your experience in the game as we wrap up today. You're a big golf course guy, and you've got some mega names on your history book, but one big one's not on there. You still haven't been to St. Andrews, or have you changed that?
Oh, God, it's so nice that you asked. So I just came from there. I was there at the end of June, and Joe Bettis, my predecessor, the executive chairman of the National Golf Foundation, is an RNA member. And we went over there with the idea that I would get my first round in on the old course. And the member ballot, which we entered, there were 3 days that we could play the old course. And the first 2 member ballots, we got skunked. And I took matters into my own hands, and I went down and I entered the singles ballot. And let's just say on Thursday, June 26th, when I went to sleep at night, I was number 22 on the waiting list. I didn't get a tee time, and I was 22 on the waiting list. When I woke up in the morning, I was number 14.
Oh.
I was like, maybe there's a chance. Just maybe. So I said, I'm going to go get a cup of coffee and walk the three blocks down to the starter and see what the story is. And I walked down and they said, I can't say whether you're going to get out today or not, but I've been making phone calls this morning. It was kind of overcast and I've had people on the waiting list I've been calling who have not been answering. I said, well, should I go get my clubs? And he said, yeah, go get your clubs. So I was all fired up. I went back to the apartment. I saw Joe and his wife, Teresa. And I said, I think I might get out. And they were pumped. And I got my golf bag. I put it over my shoulder. I walked the three blocks. I think I even shot a video where I was like doing commentary saying, oh, here I'm walking for my first round of golf. Okay. 7 hours later, I still hadn't gotten out.
So no go.
But at 3:30 in the afternoon, the guy looks over and he says, all right, I can give you guaranteed tee time, 5 o'clock. And I said, this is fantastic. Now, I've never played. I had signed up for a caddy, but it's 5 o'clock on a Friday night. And he's like, not looking good right now. And the groups before me were not. There were people coming into the pavilion saying, are there any caddies? Are there any caddies? And it was no. And, I tried not to get too disappointed. I just grabbed my pull cart and went down the first hole, and I made birdie on the first hole. And I was like, all right, the golf gods might be with me today. And as I grabbed my pull cart to take it around the first green, right around the Swilkin Burn, the assistant caddy master walks over with a 6'5", red-haired, 20-year-old St. Andrews University student who was a caddy. He's on the fifth tier of the golf team. His name is Jamie Banks. And the assistant caddy master said, he started just saying the words like, did one of you guys want a caddy? And I don't think I even let him finish the sentence. I was like on top of him. I wanted to make sure that I got the caddy. And from that moment on, caddy Jamie Banks pointed at where he told me he wanted me to hit it. And the golf gods touched me on the shoulder. And basically for the rest of the day, I hit the ball where he told me to hit it. And I finished up at 9:30 at night on the 18th hole with a birdie on 18. And I shot 74. It was the best round of golf I've ever shot in my life.
Wow. So I was going to ask you, now that you've done it, is it worth going and to tell everyone to go? I think the answer is pretty obvious at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoy looking, Jerry Tardy and Ron Witten, architecture editor emeritus, so brilliant about golf course design, and the narrative that you hear if you watch the basically the drone video of the all 18 holes on the old course. It says that the old course basically either inspired every great golf course architect and golf course after it, or it inspired them to do the complete opposite.
I've heard that as recently as this past week.
And I would just be one of those people who despite my great play, I just thought it was brilliant. The green complex is just absolutely brilliant. I love the classic courses. I love the McDonald, Rainer, Banks architecture. And there's just, Tillinghast and McKenzie. And you can see where a lot of their ideas came from. From walking the old course. It's like the Rosetta Stone.
Golf Design for Dummies, featured by St. Andrews.
Yeah,
that's great. Brilliant. Is there a particular course architect that you find yourself really leaning towards when you go and play and say, this is the blueprint of what I love?
I love C.B. McDonald and Rainer architecture. And people ask me all the time. I'm incredibly lucky. I'm a Golf Magazine rating panelist, and I have been since I left working there, 18 years ago. People always ask me, what's your favorite? And I always hedge. Okay. And I say that there's three. And I do it this way. I think Pine Valley is the greatest golf course design in the world. If I only had one round to play, it would be at Cypress Point. And if I had to choose one course to play, if I could only play one course for the rest of my life, it'd be National Golf Links of America.
It seems like you've answered this before, so I'll ask you a slightly different question. If you could only plan one type of grass for the rest of your life, what would it be?
I mean, I'm from the Northeast, so the easy answer is bent grass.
Okay. I didn't think you'd say that. I'm a big bent guy until it gets real wet and soft. Then I hate it. But I didn't expect that.
I love bent. You know, playing golf in the Northeast United States in the fall, just the best. Absolutely incredible.
I have one more bone to pick with you today, and I'll let you go, Greg. I read that you said Caddyshack, best golf movie, no brainer. And listen, man, I'm a tin cup guy for life. So I don't know if this is like an end point for us or we can agree to disagree, but I can't believe it.
You know, we have to maintain the civil spirit of debate in America. And you and I are just going to do our part of having our differences and still get along great.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I've really enjoyed our discussion today. I feel like we could chat for hours. You're awesome to talk to, and I really enjoyed my time reading into the NGF to better understand what exactly it is you're doing. And I do want to thank you, your group there, for being such great stewards of the game over the last 100 years. I think a lot of what you've done is very influential, and I appreciate you making sure the ship's headed in the right direction.
Thank you, Dan. I really enjoyed the conversation. Happy to go down any of these rabbit holes with you in the future. And, you know, I'll just say to anybody out there who works in the golf business that we exist to help you, make your golf business more successful. And give us a call if you think we might be able to help.
I love it. Hey, if you guys are out there playing golf this weekend, have a great time. Make it count. And what'd you say, Greg? Find your golf what?
Find shot euphoria.
Shot euphoria.
You something else.
You might not. Listen, golf is hard. I've just finished talking about how badly I got beat up last week, but find your golf euphoria. We'll see you guys next week. Now it's time to send it over to Don Brown for this week's Shaft Education, brought to you by True Temper.
Hey, TH Beers. Don Brown back here at Shaft University answering another one of your questions. Question this week is from someone who is fit into AMT products, but unfortunately the AMT product's not available in the irons he's looking to buy. And is there something similar from True Temper? The honest answer is not really. The AMT product is really unique in that it's extending mass technology. So three irons gonna be very light, and then we're gonna add 3 grams to every iron as we go through the set, getting heavier to the pitching wedge. Most of our other True Temper products are constant weight. So the 3-iron shaft and the pitching wedge, they're gonna weigh the same weight. So you're gonna have a hard time finding something that really matches that AMT experience. You were fitting to the AMT white, which tends to be low in the pitching wedge to kind of mid-low in the 3-iron. So if you're looking for something similar that kind of bridges that weight gap, where AMT white is very lightweight in the 3-iron and up to dynamic gold weight in the pitching wedge, you're probably gonna wanna look for something in the middle. So probably like a dynamic gold 105 if you wanna go on the lighter end, or dynamic gold 120 if you wanna go a little heavier. It's gonna give you low throughout the set, but that's probably going to be closest to the AMT. Hope that helps you out. Talk to you next time.
THP Radio on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network, your number one source for all things golf.
Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.